Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today's topic is one that for me was especially meaningful, but I think for a lot of you listening today, you would find the subject matter interesting yourself. We're going to be talking about the Dakota Sioux. We're going to be talking about a woman who took it upon herself. In fact, she was the great-granddaughter of Grey Wolf, a Dakota warrior, and the great-grandmother was Carlotta Di Francesco, who was a Spanish noblewoman. Del Barton is the name of the author of this wonderful book, A Good Day to Die. I want to welcome her husband, who is Robert Barton. He is going to be talking about the book with us because Del passed away. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I was just so impressed with this book, and I'm so pleased that I was able to get the hardcover of this. I was fascinated with the fact that Del, again, being the great-granddaughter of Grey Wolf, was born on an Indian reservation near Painted Post, New York, and she actually was able to visit with her great-grandfather because he lived to be 107 years old, and when she interviewed him, he was just a little bit past 100 years, and his mind was just especially bright, alert, and he remembered all of this information. Give us a little background about Del. How did she finally find out about her great-grandfather? How was she able to make that connection?
Well, initially, you know, she was born on the reservation and was there until the age of six. And then when she was 6 years old, Carlotta's, her great-grandmother's relatives living in Nicaragua, had a six-year-old daughter that had died.
Wow.
And they were aware of Grey Wolf's offspring and that they had a daughter about that age. So they asked if she could come and live with them to take the place of their daughter. And they were very wealthy, and so they could really take good care of her.
Mm-hmm.
And Grey Wolf realized that because she was going to be living in a white man's world, you know, that she needed to get that experience. And as much as he hated to see her go, that it was in her best interest to go there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's how she wound up going to Nicaragua and living there.
Now, your wife was born in 1923.
As far as I can establish, yes.
Now, you say as far as you can establish.
Because
when she was born, did they keep records on the reservations of the children being born?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Not back in those days.
Amazing. So they didn't even keep records on the children born on
children born on the like reservation. A birth certificate. In those days, they, you know, it was written somewhere by someone usually.
Mm-hmm.
But as Grey Wolf was so knowledgeable about everything that happened and could remember everything that happened, we have to remember that the historians for the Indians,
mm-hmm,
they would have one man that would be the historian, like the medicine man. And everything he heard, he never embellished. He had to learn it and know it and never change it. So that when they passed their history from generation to generation, it was by word of mouth.
Now,
so
the
it was
Dakota, the Dakota Sioux did not, unlike the Cherokee. The Cherokee Indians had a written language, but the Dakota Sioux did not. Am I correct?
Well, no. Now, what we have to talk about here, as far as Del is concerned, that Grey Wolf originally was a Seneca from the New York State area.
Okay.
Which is where he wound up on the reservation. He originally came from there because that's where the Senecas are from.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
when they got into battles with the white man back east, he just kept moving farther and farther west until he wound up with the Dakotas.
Yes, and that is explained in the book absolutely magnificently. Dell did an incredible job. Now, let's go back to Dell, your wife.
Mm-hmm.
You said that her stepmother was killed in a revolution
mm-hmm.
in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
And she ended up being able to come back to Connecticut.
Yes.
Now, who did she end up living with, and why did she go to Connecticut? Why didn't she go back to the Indian reservation?
Well, because now she had been living a white man's life for 10 years, from 6 to 16.
Mm-hmm. 10 years, that's a long time.
And so she was pretty white by then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was an Irish couple that came 6 months a year and worked, you know, as house servants in her stepfather's and mother's palace down there. I guess they had a huge house. And so she knew them quite well because she saw them every year of mm-hmm. her life for 6 months. And they were the only people she knew because they would come back to Hartford, Connecticut, where they had a home for the other 6 months. And so she was the only people she knew in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't begin to tell you how she got from Nicaragua to Hartford, Connecticut. Because I never got that involved in not many details of her life because I never thought I would need that information for anything
mm-hmm.
like this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true.
So we never delved in it. She never offered it, and I never asked a lot of the details.
Well, apparently a lot of her Indian experience and exposure up to the age of six indoctrinated mm-hmm. her in a certain way of that reserved demeanor that so mm-hmm. many of those that were associated with the Indian culture mm-hmm. developed, because it was almost like a discipline that was enforced. Now,
well, something else of interest is mm-hmm. that while she was in Nicaragua, she was private tutored. And by the age of 16, and by an ex-professor from a major college in the United States, I think it was Yale, but I'm not sure. That he was a retired professor, and they offered him the kind of money he couldn't refuse to come down there and teach her.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had the equivalent of a college education by the time she was 16, by the time she came into this country. So she's
wow.
very well educated. She could speak English. She could speak Spanish, of course, Castilian Spanish from Spain. And somehow, I don't know whether it was during those formative years or later, she learned to speak other languages. So she could cook and speak in four or five languages.
Amazing, amazing. Now, she got a letter from Grey Wolf, who was at that time 100 years old or a
right.
little bit older than that.
Mm-hmm.
And she ended up going to the reservation and living with him for 6 months. And she listened to his life story. Now, for her to detail this down, to be able to put it down, was quite an accomplishment at that time. And he was 6'8".
Right.
His hair was jet black.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in excellent physical condition at 100 years of age. And most of the time when you hear stories about people on reservations, that's the last thing that you expect to hear. You expect them to be sickly, not
mm-hmm.
doing well. But that wasn't the case at all. Now, when she got this letter from him, what kind of an effect did that have on her?
Well, her brother was involved in it. As I said in the book, she had six brothers, and he was the remaining one, Frank. And he was the youngest one. And he was married to a white woman, a flaming redhead. She's a very unusual woman, too, I understand. But anyway, David was the one that Frank was the one, I think, that convinced her that she could go and see him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the bearer of the letter. because his wife was the one that wrote it as he interpreted it, because, you know, what interpretation needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Was done by Frank, because he was there for the letter. And so when he came back, then Frank, I think, probably had a lot to do with her going up there and said, you really need to do this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when she got there, like you say, she walked into this room, and she expected to see a little old man there and hear this man unfolded to this magnificent height and everything, which was very surprising. But then she learned while she lived with him that he slept at night with his window wide open, and she went up to him in the winter. And when he bathed every morning in a nearby stream or river, there was ice melt, and he'd go out and bathe in that every morning. And she would say to him, how in the world do you do this? And he says, well, is your face that cold? And she said, no. And he says, well, I'm just all face.
Amazing.
And his diet was nothing. He would not eat white man's food. He would not eat any processed food.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived on big dairy farms, which is what they did for a living on the reservations up there.
Mm-hmm.
Until such time as they needed to build a dam, a big reservoir of water for Philadelphia, and then that wiped out all those farms. So they all moved to Canada.
Oh, that's an interesting aspect. I wasn't aware that dams had been built that wiped out all of their farmlands, and then they went up to Canada. So how did Canada receive the Indians then?
With open arms.
Amazing.
I mean, drive them out. That's what I was told.
Amazing.
That's about all the story I have, really. I don't have any details.
Now, when she was recording all of this information, she comes back to her,
Hartford.
Yeah, back to Hartford, the white man's life, as she has known
mm-hmm.
it. When did the two of you meet?
Well, she left Hartford and went to work for a sugar factory in a small town called Riverton, which was maybe 20 miles away. She worked in the office there, and I was head of the finishing department for the chairs, decorating and finishing. So she was the one that came around and gave us our paychecks, you know, every Friday. And
mm-hmm.
this is you got, they just handed it to you in those days. And I got called to go in the Army during the Korean War. So she's the one that took up the collection and bought the watch for me. And so I got shipped to Fort Bliss, Texas. I was going to Army school down there. And in the parking lot one day, I had to go through, I saw this woman there. I was in a vehicle. I said, boy, that looks exactly like Dell. I went back a couple of months later for Christmas, went to the factory, and they asked me if you didn't happen to run into Dell, did you? I said, why? They said, well, she went down to El Paso to live. She had been diagnosed incorrectly, I guess, with some disease that was she was going to die from within 6 months. And her decision was, well, at least I'm going to be warm. So she went to El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she could speak Spanish and everything. And she wound up being the secretary to the editor-in-chief of the El Paso Times.
Well, the two of you got together.
No, we got together because when I went back on my Christmas leave, I found out she was down there. They told me about where she was because she was working on base. So when I got back, I went and visited, found her. And so we first became close friends for quite a long time.
Now, this book, A Good Day to Die, she finished this in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody was interested in publishing it.
Nope. And she had an agent, mm-hmm. you know, who took it and went to New York and took it to all the big publishers, AA included, and different ones. But the same man wound up working for a congressman in Washington, D.C., one that was from our home, from El Paso, where we all lived. And he happened to have the book, I guess, and he was head of the staff of a congressman there, Congressman White. And so somehow he gave them the book. I guess they got talking about it or something. Somebody wanted to read it, and they read it. And they really liked it. And they had a relative that lives somewhere else, like Phoenix or something, that was had a relative that was an editor at Doubleday. And so the book went to the second person. They loved it. They sent it to the editor, relative in Doubleday, and the relative sold it to Doubleday. Now, the thing that hurt, as far as the book being published, with the deceased author, they didn't have anybody to do book signings or to promote it or anything like that or write any sequels, and so they didn't really promote it at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They just made a bunch of copies and put them out there on the bookshelves.
Well, now,
its own thing.
Yeah, there's an e-book now, and we'll talk about that before the end of the show, but I want to get into some of the material regarding the Dakota Sioux, because Dell did such an incredible job telling the story. And there is, right at the first part of the book, this statement: to those who lost their world and are no more, and to those of us who must now exist in two worlds, our hearts in the world of our fathers and our feet in the world of our conquerors. This story, and right in the foreword, the first four words are, "This story is true."
Mm-hmm.
Every person that's stated in this book, mentioned in this book, she portrayed as accurately as she could. She did 20 years of extensive research and lots of hours.
Let me tell you about some of that, if I may.
Please do.
Research. When we lived in El Paso, Dell had, as she said, told me that all the Indians have adopted parents wherever they moved to. And so she had adopted Apache parents up on the Escobedo Indian Reservation up near Ruidoso, New Mexico. And she came to know a very good friend of those Indians, Miss Eve Ball, who's published quite a few books on cowboys and Indians from the Southwest. And so we would go up there many, many weekends and stay with Miss Ball, because she had rentals and she had a antique shop and things. But she had become very good friends with the Indians. And she was very good friends with the head of the Jicarillas at the time, Istak Luigi. And so Dell had many resources up there directly with the Apaches, you know, to get a tremendous amount of knowledge from that. And this went on for years.
One of the very first stories that she relates in the book is Crying Boy.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about Crying Boy, and of course this was Gray Wolf as a young person. And among the Indians, they gave labels, and he had been a crybaby, and that's why they called him a crying boy. And so one of the very first things that she mentions is about the Vision Quest and how the young men in the Dakota tribe had to prove that they were worthy of getting what they considered a real name. They all had these little nicknames that were tacked onto them.
That's right.
Dependent on what behavior they exhibited. There was another young boy that was called Lame Dog. There was Small Owl. And all of these are real people that are being discussed here. But what I love is the vibrancy that Dell gives in this writing that she did. It is so beautifully done. You feel like you're right there and you're going through the experiences that these people went through. So it starts out with Gray Wolf and how he had to earn the name Gray Wolf. And at the time, this was a very rough period. Now, he had the good fortune of living for a number of years as a young person in an environment that involved the old culture. But by the time he was, I believe it was in his adolescent period, middle to late adolescent years that the stuff with the white men started, the slaughters began. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time, and of course he had been given the name Gray Wolf, that there was so much pain and so much agony, and this was in preparation for his adulthood, and there was an elder that recognized his leadership qualities. And this was before Custer's Last Stand, before all of the Indian nations gathered together to make a stand. But the chief, and I'm trying to remember his name.
Red Fox?
Yes, yes, Red, that one. He said to Gray Wolf, and I remember this vividly, he recognized his talents, and he said, if we fight, and he was trying to control the younger men, because they were all angry, and like teenagers, they don't think, they don't know how to think, they have to be disciplined. So much of the tradition of discipline, determination, dedication, self-control, these things that were expected of the males of the tribe started going absolutely out the window. And I, you know, it's really a very powerful emotional book. It must have been very difficult for Dell, knowing of her ancestry, to sit and write about these tragedies where villages of men, women, and children were just absolutely slaughtered in cold blood. Murdered.
Well, the idea of the book is, in the beginning, you learn about the Indians as real people,
mm-hmm.
not as savages. You know, with their way of life, with their traditions, and with the things that they do, their ceremonies and so forth. And then you see the impact on that, these real people that you can laugh with and so forth, tease each other and everything. And so you get to know those real people, and then you get to see the impact of the white man coming has on them,
mm-hmm.
and how it ultimately destroys that way of mm-hmm. life forever.
Right. And the rapidness of that destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And then Gray Wolf and Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse, originally, you couldn't get him to fight at all. He abhorred violence.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he and Gray Wolf went through experiences of seeing the destruction and the slaughter, Crazy Horse then totally went the opposite and became a warrior that was extremely feared by the white man. In fact, they made sure that the white man did not know where he was because they would have just used him in some way that was heinous. As a display. So they managed to cart off the body after his last great battle, after he was cut down, and they buried him, and to this day they really don't know where they buried him. I know some people say that they do, but it has not been made common knowledge because that was not to be done. He was to be respected and honored, and they wouldn't allow the white men to have it. But it's fascinating to look at how life can turn someone who was to be a medicine man, like Crazy Horse was going to be, into the warrior that was going to die fighting. And Gray Wolf, who ended up, as you said, leaving his own environment, going and joining the Apaches, and that was heart-wrenching because of the story of the Apaches and what they had gone through, and he had, when he first came across them, he thought that they were the filthiest people he'd ever met, and then he learned that these people were just barely surviving, that they had been slaughtered.
You know, I can relate to that, you know, better than people from this part of the country, because I lived in the Southwest for over 40 years, and I could see the conditions that they had to live in,
mm-hmm.
with the lack of water and so forth, and it's just amazing that they were able to survive.
Well, I think of the misunderstandings that people have, and this is the wonderful gift that Dell's writing gives. She shows how the Indian people really kept their environments very clean, and mm-hmm. that what was often described as a dirty Indian, or, you know, they're this, they're that, they're the other, was actually because they became impoverished. They couldn't get to water. And the reservations, many of them that they were put on, were this awful, awful land environment that the white men didn't want anything to do with. And so they were hoping that they could absolutely destroy all of these people. And Grey Wolf himself, the story of him meeting the woman that he made his wife, and she was, you know, as we said at the beginning, Carlotta, she was a Spanish noblewoman, and eventually she came to understand the Indian way of life and honored it. But it was a tough thing for her to do because she had no other paradigms than the sheltered environment that she had been in. But eventually, because the white man killed her son.
Murdered her son, yes.
Murdered her son. She all of a sudden got the clarity. She saw the horrific stuff that had been done, and she understood where she couldn't have understood before. This is such a powerful, powerful book. And with your ebook that you have, I know you can get it on Amazon.com. There's a Kindle version. And I don't know if people can reach you, but Robert, I think Mary has done such a service for everyone in being able to put it on the Kindle so that people can read it.
Yes.
When your wife left this legacy, where do you want to go with this legacy? What do you want to do with it now? I mean, is Mary going to be going around and making talks? And because this book is magnificent. Students should read this. They need to understand this.
Well, it's not a book that's going to change anything, except hopefully give people a better understanding of the people who lived in a way that was inclusive of nature, not destroying it, but living with nature, and not being a people who were into material things, which is why they didn't go that direction. They just had a completely different type of lifestyle and society, which was, I think, beautiful. And maybe you have to be in some of the environments I've been in to realize that, and maybe know Del, like I knew her, to realize what a wonderful way that was to live at the time they were living it, before the white men came.
Well,
it was something very beautiful.
Yes, it is quite beautiful, but their standards and their ethics, this is something that I don't think many people are able to recognize.
Mm-hmm.
They had standards. They had ethics.
Oh,
they
yeah.
really held a code of personal responsibility and accountability.
Yeah.
And it was war that ended up destroying it. And that is something that when you look at that and you look at various aspects of history, whether it's relating to the Indians or other cultures, you realize that so many times the lust for power, the desire to conquer or to take over land, property, whatever it is that you want to call it, for the sake of acquiring it and then getting the ownership. And if you can't own people, if they think for themselves, then you destroy them. That has been repeated so many times in human history. It's absolutely disgusting, but it is a reality. But there is so much information in this book that makes us realize that as human beings, their code, their standard of honor, integrity, purposeful action, being thoughtful, being alert, being mindfully present, all of this was demanded. They wouldn't accept anything less. And if you didn't meet the code, you were out. They wouldn't tolerate it. And it was for men and women both. And I was pleased to see how the women were respected and how their opinions made a difference. And there were various, you know, things that went on at that time in history just because of the way life was and how you had to do things in a particular patterning. It's really wonderful reading. So for those of you listening, I would encourage you to check out A Good Day to Die by Del Barton. Now, this is a novel, but it's true. It's a true story. It's about the Dakota Sioux their last days on the great plains of America. It is something that I think, whether you are white, black, yellow, green, purple, Indian, I don't care. It's important to read it because it is important to know what history is. And American history has a lot of levels to it, some of it wonderful, some of it really bad. But we need to be aware of it so that we educate ourselves. Robert, I want to thank you very much for being my guest today. And I'm so grateful that your wife did this before she passed away. And I'm grateful that Mary is enabling this material to be available to other people. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
You're very welcome.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a minute. Don't forget, you can get A Good Day to Die by Del Barton on Amazon.com, the Kindle version. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open. 888-815-9756 is the number to call in if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Again, 888-815-9756. Also, I want to remind those of you in the Pacific Northwest of the Emerald Spiral Expo that is coming up on March 26th, which is a Saturday. It's a one-day event. It's being held at Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. I'm going to be there, and I'll have a booth. So I'll be able to chat with you and interact with you doing mini sessions, but also I'll have an abundance of books. I'm purging my library. I've got to make room for the other 200 to 400, 600 that I get in the year, and it's coming up. Oh, my goodness. I've got book overload right now. So a lot of them are going to be available for you to look at and see if you'd like to take them home with you. So check out emeraldspiral.com, and you'll get all the details and information about this wonderful event that's coming up on March the 26th. So again, Give them a chat. Just go in and look at the site, emeraldspiral.com, and you'll find out all the details regarding this wonderful event on March 26th. I want to read a letter that is in the back of Del Barton's book because I think it's so important for young people to spend time with the elders, to spend time with those people who have walked a path that they're never going to walk, and take time to listen. And this is what Del had done. But this is the letter that stimulated Dell going to visit her great-grandfather, who was 100 years old, Gray Wolf. And this was in December of 1949 that they figured out this is when the letter was sent to her great-grandfather. This is how it read. Dear Dell, on the day which you will read this, I will dwell in my mind of 26 snows ago. The dawn looked upon a barren earth that had been covered with a blanket of white during the sleeping of the sun. As the Great Spirit laid his fleece upon the earth to warm it, so that night he laid in my grandson's lodge a child, a woman child, to warm the heart of her father. He made this child fair of skin, likened to her grandmother, to warm the lonely heart of an old man, her father's father. As is the custom of our people, I took the woman child in my arms and prayed to the sun to make her of gentle heart and compassionate spirit, as becomes an Indian maiden. I was unmindful of these new times when a maiden may make her voice heard in deciding of important matters, and so I did not pray a prayer for a brave that she should keep forever in the ways of her fathers. This I forgot. And for this I am an old man, unfavored by the sweetness of a gentle smile from the maiden I named Melissa. Taken by her grandmother's people, she turned away from her own and forgot the teachings of her fathers. She claimed herself a white woman and lived their ways and among them. She thought the Indian ignorant and cruel and uncultured. But this was because of her guidance that taught her shame of her people. Was the Indian who fought for his lands, his home, his women, and his children more cruel than the greedy white man who crosses the waters and fights for power and for plunder? He speaks of equality and democracy, but did he, or has he, made practice of this in this land? Where, then, is the white man more than his Indian brother? These tired eyes have looked on more than 100 snows and summers, and they starve for a look upon the countenance of Melissa. This tired voice would speak to her of her fathers and teach her of her noble forebears. Her very name is Melissa, which means pure, like a blanket of snow, and warm and comforting and protecting. Yet she carries the name of a white woman, denying the love of her people. I would speak to this maiden Melissa, granddaughter of my son, daughter of my son's son, and sister of Kanawaba, pride of the Seneca Nation. Well, as you know, Dell did visit her great-grandfather, staying with him for 6 months, and she dedicated the next 20 years of her life to the writing of this book. And she finished it less than 2 years before she died in 1971. Phenomenal story. Understanding perspectives of different times, different places, different experiences. It's so easy to get caught up with a Hollywood version, a John Wayne special, bad guys, good guys. Yes, we all get stuck there. But it really is significant when you can hear the story and feel it in your heart and know that ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance typically creates fear. Ignorance often, along with the fear, supplements a superstitious base that cripples the thinking and the understanding of people. I feel very fortunate because I have been able to experience various paradigms of perspectives. And I would like for you to know that too. I think that that is so important. If we don't take the time to listen, if we don't take the time to ask questions, why did people do something like this? How did they really live? If we don't take time to listen to the elders, then we walk in blindness. As the saying goes, if you're not willing to learn from history, you are going to repeat the mistakes that others made, suffering perhaps even worse than if you took the time to learn, to be aware, and to be awake to the realities that you'll be facing. It's very important. I was having a discussion with someone earlier today relative to that very issue, and how so easily are the elders brushed aside that they have no value whatsoever. Oh, you're old. What do you know? I got news for you. Sit down some time and talk with a veteran that survived World War II, that was up to his guts in mud and slime and blood, fighting on a battlefield, freezing cold, lousy supplies, not even given decent clothing, battling for the right for people to be able to be free. Listen to those that were experienced with losing farms. Listen, read, think, observe. It's important. We all have to learn it. I remember a time in my life I was very flippant, and I just didn't realize certain things, and I'll never forget someone correcting me. I'd made some flippant remark. Well, maybe it's best that this type of thing happens. Who cares? And this person turned around to me and said, it makes a difference. Stop and think about what you have said. If this particular action, which was a very negative statement on my part, happens, do you realize the effect it can have on the lives of other people? And for a moment, and I was quite young when this occurred, but the person made an impact on me, and I realized that I had been very flippant, and I had been very rude. So we all have to learn. Nobody's exempt from that. But be open to learning. It makes a difference in your life. You'll be richer because of it. Don't just take what someone says at face value. Be willing to question it. Go and visit your library. Pay attention to what's going on. And remember, there's a lot of people out there that have their agendas, especially when it comes to politics. They're going to flap their gums over a lot of things and not mean a word that they say. So pay attention. Be willing to listen. You'll be amazed at what you find out. We have a great interview tomorrow with Ken Mershon. We're going to be talking about two of his publications. One is about a children's book. It's an internationally directed book. It's one of the best I've ever seen for kids, showing multiple languages. Of course, when kids are young, that's a great time to teach them different languages. It's wonderful. And also, we're going to be talking about networking. Yes, I know, whenever we hear that, you usually go, oh, good grief. We have heard that word abused so much. But Ken has some wonderful suggestions, which you're going to be hearing about. And then on Friday, we are going to be talking with Naheed Sewell. This is a Middle Eastern woman who has written a book called The Ruby Tear Catcher. This, again, is a novel that's based on truth. And she has just done an incredible job with this. It is about a woman who is imprisoned and in Iran and what she went through and her family and the history. It is, I'm telling you, a very powerful book. So we have got two wonderful people coming up this week, and I hope that you will join me because it's going to be quite dynamic in listening. I wanted to share a poem with, by the way, here's the call-in line if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, 888-815-9756. Monique White, I have this beautiful illustration in front of me of a pot of gold. Ah, yes, 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 yes. The 17th, St. Patty's Day will be coming up. And, of course, we always think of the leprechauns and those lucky four-leaf clovers and the pot of gold that the leprechauns always like to hide from us. Well, this is a beautiful illustration with a pot of gold that the pot itself is gold, filled with golden coins, and there is a rainbow that is coming out of it. It's just beautiful. And she wrote these words, a rainbow over the horizon, a pot of gold, a shamrock path, a hush of fairy wings. These set my Irish feet to dancing. Ah, yes, wonderful, wonderful stuff. Well, I thought I would share with you a story about an entrepreneur that is just absolutely incredible, and we're going to have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, so don't go away. We're going to take a break for just a moment, and when we come back, you're going to find out about a woman that braved the odds and ended up with success. It can happen to you. Believe it. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a moment.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right, Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. Muriel Siebert. This is a woman that accomplished, well, just an incredible amount. She is a lady of mature years, but I want you to know that no matter what your background is, in the United States of America, you have a chance to achieve what people say is impossible for you to achieve. Why? Because you have a right of choice. And this is what being an entrepreneur is all about. This woman was born and raised in Ohio, and she said, at the time when I was growing up, most women were concentrating on careers, not careers, on having babies, being moms. That's it, and wives. Very few women were encouraged to have a career. Well, she decided that she was going to be a part of the New York Stock Exchange. Yep, that's right. And it was at a time when women just were not allowed to be involved, period. Now, a little of her background, her mom came from a large family. There were 11 kids in the family, and they had all been born in Hungary. And her father, well, he was a dentist, and he had a degree in engineering, and he was able to meet up with Muriel's mother, who came, the family came over from Hungary and settled in the Cleveland area. And she said, my father died very, very young, and so my mother had to work, all of his kids had to work. She said, I learned the value of money at a very young age. And she said she happened to have the opportunity. They weren't impoverished because everyone in the family was working to the best of their capacity. And she said she happened to go to New York City when she was young and was at the New York Stock Exchange. And she said, wow, this is what I want. She fell in love with New York. She fell in love with the stock exchange. She fell in love with the United Nations. She tried to get a job there, but that didn't work out because she didn't have multiple language capabilities. So she decided she was going to become a trainee in the research department of a brokerage firm. And she said she worked her way up. And she began to learn about stock analysis, and she said, finally, she was able to get a $5 a week raise. She was so excited about that because she could spend 20 cents more on her lunch. It's amazing how little things impress us in very specific ways. Well, she specialized, and she began getting an excellent reputation as an analyst that was focusing on the airline industry. Now, she changed firms in New York. There were quite a few choices. And she actually worked her way up to become a partner in a firm. But no matter what she did, she was always dramatically paid under what the male counterparts were earning. She said it really made her mad. She said she was making a good living. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that they said, because you're a woman, you don't need the amount of money a man does. Well, that's a farce. Well, one of her clients came to her one day. His name was Gary Tsai, and he used to run Fidelity Capital and started the Manhattan Fund. And she had chatted with him. She'd gotten to know him, and she would ask him, where in the world could I be in this environment where I could get paid equally to my male counterparts because they're making 50% more than I am? And he said, buy a seat on the stock exchange and work for yourself. Can you imagine how that was? Just a what? What do I do? And there wasn't a woman on the stock exchange at that time. He said, who cares? There's no law against a woman owning a seat on the stock exchange. Well, by the way, she went and read the stock exchange constitution. Yes, there is one. And she said, he's right. A woman can buy a seat on the stock exchange. She said, however, actually doing it, well, that was a whole different kettle of fish, and it wasn't easy. Well, the banks had to give her a loan for this, and they told her, now this is how the banks work, to get the loan, they had to know that she had the seat on the stock exchange. So she called a friend who worked with a bank and said, I guess I'm not getting the seat. And he said, don't worry about it. 15 minutes later, she was called. The loan was given to her. David Rockefeller signed the loan application. That's how she got the seat on the stock exchange. She said, nobody was going to be there to bail me out if I failed. And she said, I was supporting my mom at the time that this happened. She said, I figured worst case scenario, I could go back to being an analyst. Well, she worked hard, her talents were recognized, and she was controlling her own destiny. She said, I could make the same amount of money as my peers, and if I wanted to make that consistent, I had to earn it. Her only employee that she was able to get was a male secretary. After 2 years, she was able to add two partners and ended up getting a brokerage operating as Muriel Siebert and Company. And she said it was just absolutely amazing. She had challenges with her firm, and they ended up becoming, in 75, a discount commission house. And she said, there I was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal the very next day after we had gotten licensing for that. She said we were thriving just absolutely wonderfully. And in the late 70s, she was appointed the superintendent of banks for the state of New York. And that was not the end of her story. She just kept on working and working and working. And she has had her 40th anniversary of her election to the membership of the New York Stock Exchange. And she said, we are so fortunate in this country. She said, I wear an American flag ring as a reminder that it's only in America where I could have had the chance to pursue my dreams. Powerful story. That is out of A Cup of Cappuccino for the Entrepreneur Spirit, Women's Entrepreneurs Edition. Wonderful, wonderful story. Remember, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You have a right and the privilege of being able to reach for the star that you so earnestly want in your life. Forget the moon. Aim for the star. The universe is wide open. Donna Siebel here. We'll be talking to you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Have a magnificent life. And smile. Life is full of abundant blessings. Bye for now. See you tomorrow.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.